You may be one of the many folks turning to gardening in this time of isolation. On the show today, we'll talk to our guest about how your garden can help your house. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Home improvement expert John Freiberger back with us. He's a registered home inspector, specializes in designing air barrier systems that reduce energy consumption. So we're going to talk with him about how to divert water away from your house and, of course, take your other home improvement questions as well. I hope you can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And John Freiberger, welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Larry.
There are lots of home improvement projects we can tackle while we're staying at home. Why did you choose to talk about diverting water through landscaping?
Well, Larry, we know what Wisconsin has been like the last 3 years. We've had immense amounts of rain. And because of that, when I am doing home inspections or people are simply calling me out for a historic evaluation or a maintenance evaluation, I'm seeing increased rates of damage to our homes due to moisture. And so I thought that we need to talk a little bit about what we can do to drain the moisture away from our house. Now, we've talked a lot about siding and windows and flashing and roofs and things, but we sort of forget that our house is sort of like a giant sponge. I mean, most of what is in our house is porous to one extent or another. And so if it's wet around the base of our house, that moisture is going to move into our house and it's going to cause some damage.
Indeed, it will. Well, you know, how do we tell if we have a drainage issue?
Well, it's pretty simple. And hopefully you have perhaps up on your Facebook page a checklist that I put together for looking at our houses in the spring.
We did indeed.
Good. Excellent. Well, let's take a look at a couple of those. And I tried to rank some of this in my checklist by how expensive the problem is going to be to fix. Now, I got pictures from a listener yesterday up in Door County, and they're going to buy a little house up there, a little weekend place. And it's built in the 20s, Dutch lap siding, which means there's no sheathing on the walls. The siding and the sheathing is all the same thing. And the siding's buried in about 8 inches of dirt. Well, that siding's probably been buried for a lot of years. So it is going to be, that wood is going to be soaking up moisture and is going to be decaying, causing insects and mold and everything else. So the first thing we want to look at is we need to have some separation between the porous materials on our house, between the sponge part of our house and the grade. And what we really want to see around our house is 6 to 8 inches of clearance between the soil and any wood, any siding of other sorts, such as LP Smart Side is very popular, Hardy Plank Cementous Siding. All of those are supposed to be separated from the soil so that we don't have direct contact and then have capillary action pulling water into the siding material.
Makes a lot of sense. And you know, this whole business about gardening, Ron in Madison has something that I think you wanted to talk about as well. Let's go to Ron and see what's on his mind. Hey, Ron.
Hi, Tiny. In this century, I helped install a few rain gardens, mainly planting, you know, appropriate vegetation. Other century, I was a soil scientist. I'm calling about rain gardens, infiltration trenches, infiltration basins. And the last time I looked it up, rain gardens are not officially regulated by the state government, but the trenches and basins, which are a little different, have very nitpicky regulations, and they both must be designed by a professional engineer, which the homeowner must pay hundreds or probably thousands of dollars. I also want to throw out there again, the way the regulations are written for infiltration trenches, they're wrong. They assume that a trench full of septic tank gravel is 100% airspace. That's the way the formula is written. Research, I think out of the state of Maine, a properly done trench with uniform size gravel is only 48% airspace and it's 52% gravel. And so that's got to be corrected at the very minimum. But for someone who wants to do it themselves, is it possible to do 100% of the engineering design and measurements and soil sampling and then have a professional engineer double check all the calculations against the regulations? Is that even possible within the state of Wisconsin?
Well, it certainly is. Now, one of the things that I hope is up on Larry's Facebook page is a couple of websites. One that's been around for a long time is from the city of St. Paul, Minnesota. Their Department of Public Works many years ago noted that some of their flat, poorly drained neighborhoods would benefit from rain gardens. And so the city actually has on their website a rain garden guidance and design form that you can look at. There's also companies like Gardening Know-How that have rain garden designs. The GardenDesign.com has rain garden designs. So people can certainly take a look at these. Now, you know, you're a soil scientist, and you and I both know that there's a big difference between the sandy soil in Stevens Point and the heavy clay that is in some places around Madison. And so we do get into some difficulties about how deep our basin needs to be in our rain garden. Because if we're in a sandy soil, it can be fairly shallow. But if we're in clay, we're going to have to increase the depth of the rain garden perhaps by 400% to be able to manage exactly the same volume of water that that shallow sandy one can follow. So the problem is that engineering is expensive. There aren't a lot of soil engineers out there. But I'm hoping that at least if people have an interest in a rain garden, and if they live in a flat neighborhood in Madison or any other city, sometimes a rain garden is one of the few ways you can manage water because you can't drain it off your lot really any other way because the lots are dead flat. What the state is telling us in the Uniform Dwelling Code is that when we build a new house, we are supposed to have a half inch a foot drop per 10 feet around the house. In other words, 5 inches and 10 feet. I'd say 80% of the new houses that I inspect do not meet that standard. So we have a real problem with drainage, and I certainly agree with you that rain gardens are a great way of handling it. Infiltration trenches, yes. I usually use 40% airspace, and that's for a wash stone that is half inch to inch and a half. Permeable pavements, permeable patios, all of those things will help manage water on flat lots by getting it into the ground. The other big problem that we have in Madison is sometimes some of our lots are very small, and we really want to have a rain garden at least 10 feet away from our foundation, or we may be charging the soil with moisture that ends up, you know, the basement becomes part of our rain garden, and we don't want that.
Oh, man. Are those the kinds of problems you've been seeing, John? What have you been seeing lately?
Well, I'm seeing a lot of older houses in flat neighborhoods with water in the basement. And water in the basement is water in the basement if the basement's just a basement. One of the few things that Frank Lloyd Wright was correct about was we really shouldn't have basements in Wisconsin because they have a tendency to get wet. But the real big problem that I'm seeing, Larry, and I'm seeing this in litigation again and again, and with some very, very high price tags on it, is I'm seeing wet finished basements. And some of these basements didn't leak the first 30, 40 years that the house existed, but then in the last 3 years, suddenly we have water coming in behind drywall and plaster, behind wood paneling. We have houses full of mold. We have finished basements where we're tearing out part or all of the finished basements and all of the flooring. I've had a recent one in Oregon where the family had to move out of the house. Everybody got sick from the mold. So we need to find ways that we can get this water away from the houses in the flat neighborhoods. And where the neighborhoods aren't flat, we need to follow the standard guidelines of the half inch per foot for 10 feet to get this water away from our house. Plus, we have to have the separation where we've got some foundation between the siding or the, any kind of cladding that we have, be it stone, brick, or siding, and the soil. So there's some big economic consequences to having a leaking basement if you have a finished basement.
Yeah, if you have a finished basement, well, so the house is, let's say we've got a house on flat land and you don't have a lot of space and you've got water in your basement, then what is the approach?
Well, we do everything we can on the outside. We extend the drains, the drain pipes off the downspouts as far as we can. As Ron suggested, we maybe take a look at having a rain garden out in the backyard. And I think, Larry, I think everybody knows what a rain garden is, but maybe just let me give 15 seconds here. And basically what we're talking about, Larry, is a depression in your yard that can hold a good amount of water. And generally what we plant in it is wet prairie plants. The reason we do that is we want to have plants in there, not just grass. You know, grass has maybe 3-4 inches of root. But we want some wet prairie plants that maybe have 2 and 3 feet deep roots. So they're keeping that soil open. So the idea is we can drain our downspouts, or maybe the yard is slightly pitched, towards something that basically looks like a decorative flower bed. In fact, if you're putting in wet prairie plants, some of which are 3 and 4 feet high, it basically, to everybody who enters your yard, goes, gee, what a nice looking flower bed. They don't really realize that it's a piece of engineering to manage the water problems on your site. The other thing we can do with waters coming into our basement is we can manage the water as it comes in. It is extremely hard and expensive to stop water from coming into a basement. But if we have an unfinished basement, let's say we've got a house on the east side of Madison or Stevens Point that was built in the 1930s. It has somewhat porous concrete walls. It has cracks in the walls, and it leaks every time it rains, and there's water on the floor. Well, if we do put in a retrofitted drain system and some pit and some pump, we can at least collect that water as it comes in. And you know, my basement out here on the farm, Larry, is an old farmhouse stone basement. It is going to leak every time it rains heavily. I put in a water collection system, and it really doesn't worry me to have a little bit of water coming through the wall. But I don't store anything down there, and I don't have it finished area.
Makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. Sarah, and Ron, again, I thank you for calling. Sarah in West Bend has something relating to this, I believe. Sarah, hello.
Yes, good morning. We live in a neighborhood association with 75 homes, and we are the property that's closest to the lake, about 200 yards away. So essentially, if you can picture it, we're kind of at the bottom of the bowl. All the other homes mm-hmm. in the area are elevated higher and away. And we are having a problem with the drainage of everyone's sump pumps and water throughout the neighborhood. We have a lake access road, a gravel road in our backyard, and as the drain water comes, it's supposed to come along parallel to the lake road, but as it enters our property, it makes a sharp left right towards our house. And the problem's gotten worse and worse over the year. The ground is settling, and I contacted some stormwater engineers who came out, and they looked for the master grading plans from the neighborhood through the county clerk courthouses and such, and they found no record. And, you know, I've called my local county and township, and they said it's really a lake, an association property problem, and they should pay for it. And the association's kind of balking at the price and kind of wants to do a DIY ditch and just kind of dig up our backyard a little bit. It's association land, technically, where they want to dig. But mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, you know, our property feels the brunt of it, but what would your advice be on how to mitigate this problem?
Well, you've taken the correct first steps, but unfortunately, you didn't get a result. If this is a fairly modern plat, generally when you do a plat plan, you have to put the drainage areas and describe the drainage on the plan. And you've looked for that, and unfortunately, you can't find it. The nice thing about those plot plans is they are legal documents. And so you can't modify or change that. You know, a neighbor can't decide that the water that's supposed to go west on his lot is now going to go east and go into somebody's basement. So it's unfortunate that that doesn't exist, because this should have been engineered when the plat was approved, unless this is from, you know, the 40s or the early 50s or something like that. Generally, you do need to talk to either an engineer, a civil engineer, or you need to talk to a landscape architect or a landscaper that actually knows something about drainage. Now, a lot of the landscapers know how to make things pretty, but they don't know how to manage water. Whether this is an association issue or not, is you're going to have to take a look at your condo documents, and sometimes one has to just hire an attorney to look at it, and it doesn't cost a lot to look at it. But what you're going to want to do is try to restore what was once there. And it sounds like from what you're saying is there used to be a nice parallel ditch and it used to drain the water. And I expect, Sarah, what's happened here in the last 5 years is because you're in the bowl and it's rained so much, you've got a lot more hydrostatic head pressure and you've got a lot more seepage into the basement, which is being collected by everybody's drainage systems and then being pumped out into the yard to flow past your house. So we have a problem that has probably gotten much worse or maybe simply developed in the last 3 years. So you are going to have to get some, you know, some expert advice to properly plan this out. It, of course, has to be erosion proof. We can't send soils and things into the lake. So maybe give one more try in trying to find these plat plans. You know, maybe the condo association has something in its files that they don't even know that they have. And then you're probably going to have to get some professional help to get this designed, unfortunately.
Yeah, good luck, Sarah. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates, our guest today. Great to have him with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your home today, and we've zeroed in a little bit on diverting water with landscaping as we visit with John Freiberger, Wisconsin Registered Home Inspector of Freiberger & Associates. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Questions or comments for him, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. John in Toma has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I wanted to express the importance of rain gutters and how important they are. Keep them clean. Keep them draining. If you got, like, trees and stuff, like I used to live in Vesper, Wisconsin, and I had a lot of maple trees, and they would get plugged up, and I had to clean them up quite regularly. And if I didn't, I'd get water in my basement, you know. And if I kept the rain gutters clean, I had no problem with water in the basement at all. So.
John, thank you for calling. And John Freiberger, that's probably pretty good advice there.
No, certainly it's a good point, because if the water is coming off of our roof and then landing 6 inches to 2 feet from our foundation, water in the soil tends to move, all things being equal, at about a 45-degree angle. So if it's coming a couple feet from the house, it's going to find its way into our crawl space or our basement. But if we collect it and then get that downspout 6-8 feet away from the house, that is going to help a great deal.
John in St. Germain up next. John, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, John. Thanks for taking my call. This is a little bit off the topic of water drainage and management, but it is related to kind of a home improvement issue outside regarding a deck. I've got an old deck that I need to rebuild, at least all the visible portions of it, and I'm thinking of using one of the synthetics for the actual horizontal decking part, yet at the same time I'd like to kind of retain some of the look of what I currently have, and that would involve using actual wood for the posts and railings and horizontal balusters and the other visible portions of the deck. So I guess I'm wondering about the wisdom or if there's any real issues that I don't see with combining synthetic decking with what would be pressure-treated stained wood for some of the other elements of the deck.
Hmm. What do you think, John?
John, I don't see any problem at all with that. I'm beginning to really appreciate the more recent solid PVC decking material. Now, we had some decking material that came out 20 years ago, and usually it was a wood fiber with some sort of covering over it, a PVC or a thermoplastic or something that was maybe a 16th of an inch thick. And it was great until you scratched it. And then it started coming apart and started shrinking and started twisting and started doing almost everything. It seems that the modern materials, like one company that comes to mind is AZEK, A-Z-E-K, and I know it's widely available in Wisconsin. But they have, their material is solid PVC. It will move if you have real long pieces in the sunlight, especially in a darker color. So you have to be a little bit careful about your lengths. But they have fastening systems for a lot of the artificial decking now where the decking has a groove on either side and you secure a cleat to your treated joists. And the decking, if it is moving, can actually expand and contract a little bit because it is not screwed down tight the way we screw down, you know, treated southern pine. So I think it's a perfectly acceptable idea. And, you know, even environmentally, we treat all of this wood, it lasts for X years, and then we throw it all away and replace it. I'm hoping that these modern PVC and other plastic polymer-type products are going to last longer than the wood, and we're not going to be using the chemicals that we've had to use in the woods. Now, Larry, let me just add one other thing off my checklist on decks.
Yes.
When I inspect a house, I always take a flashlight, look under the deck, and I'm looking for two things. And one of them is whether the deck is structurally built correctly and whether it's decaying. But the other thing I'm looking for is grading. Frequently, I look under a deck and I find a foot deep hole that basically the deck is a giant bowl. So it's a rain garden in the wrong place. You know, it is a rain garden without plants and it's right next to your foundation. So if John is redoing his deck, I want him to do two things. First, I want him to go to the American Wood Council, and I want him to download for free their deck guide. The American Wood Council is one of the standard councils as recognized by the Uniform Dwelling Code in Wisconsin, and their advice is incorporated into the Wisconsin Code. And their guide, which has all these drawings and specifications, is designed to conform to the Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code as well, if you happen to be in Illinois or Minnesota, to the International Residential Code. It's absolutely free. It has great detail. And if John's got some structural problems with that deck, it's going to tell him how to fix it or strengthen it. And then the second thing I want him to do is if there is a bowl, a permeation bowl underneath that deck, I want him to get that filled, maybe put some visqueen over it, some wash stone that he can blow his maple leaves off of easily, so that when he's done with it, he's got something that is not a drainage issue, is perfectly safe, conforms to code, and he's going to get to enjoy for many years without spending a lot of time on maintenance.
Oh, makes good sense. John, does that help?
Yeah, I'll check out that American Deck Council site and see what I can find there. That's wonderful. You don't see any issues, though, with combining some wood products with synthetic decking in the overall construction, do you?
No, two things, John. First is American Wood Council, American Wood Council Deck Guide. And what I want you to look for, if you're looking at, if you go to your local lumber yard or your local supply house, they're going to have all kinds of deck stuff to look at. But try to get the stuff where you don't screw through the material, where rather it has a side fastener that the deck material simply clips into. Because if you get, you know, let's say this is going to be on the south side of your house and they've got a deep maroon, which is sort of a pretty one, you put that on and you get a 100-degree day on the sunlight, that decking may move by an eighth of an inch. So you want it to be able to slide in these fasteners, not be pulling and pushing against screws that you've put through it. Is that clear?
Yes, it is. That's very good. And I thank you for your comments and your information you provided.
All right. Thank you very much, John, for calling. Appreciate it. Bard emailed, by the way, that the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has an excellent rain garden guidebook that includes determining soil type, sizing, plants to use, and so forth. It was recently updated, and it's free. Just Google WDNR rain gardens. And you could also check out the Healthy Lakes site at UW Extension for more rain garden guidance. So there we go.
That's right. Those are two great sites. I didn't realize that the DNR had updated theirs.
Yeah, it's updated. Dennis in Alton, Minnesota. Excuse me, Afton, Minnesota. It's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Larry and guests and everybody. I really appreciate listening to your guests who are always speaking from experience. And your guest mentioned, he said, one of the things Frank Lloyd Wright did correctly was to say, maybe you shouldn't have a basement in Wisconsin. But anyway, my experience working with contractors is that we may have paid a price here for just making things look good, and that is helping them correct flat roofs. And I call it the fighting alligators stage of my life, where we're tearing off 3, 4, 5 inches of tar off these flat roofs. I'm just wondering if your guest would want to expand on some of those potential architectural errors. And my phone isn't the greatest, so I'll let you talk away on radio, okay?
All right. Thanks, Dennis. Well, John,
Thanks, Dennis. Well, when we restored the Jacobs II house, which was built in 1947, and I think we restored that in 83, that had the original tar roof on it. So that was, 35 years or something, that old tar roof lasted on that house, which was pretty amazing. But nowadays, we have much better materials than Frank ever dreamed were going to exist. I mean, in the old days, it was tar and felt was basically it. Sometimes they used 45-pound paper and tried gluing it together, and that didn't work real well. But with the modern thermoplastics that we have, the modern vinyls, and the EPD on the rubber roofing that we've had for many years, we do now have roofs that really can work pretty well. The problem we have with a lot of them, Larry, is that you get up on the roof to inspect it, and you notice that it's a giant pond. The problem is that our houses, all wood compresses, wood will compress, dry wood will compress as much as 1/4 inch per floor. And then we have what's called deflection, which is simply bending under load. So that unless you build a flat roof with a crown in it, as it settles over time, most flat roofs are going to have these low areas, and we have a lot of water sitting in it. And of course, that water is heavy. So the water sits there and surcharges the weight, and it causes more compression, so the roof gets even deeper. So when we approach these roof issues, what we try to do is we try to add insulation over the top, and we use a tapered system. So we'll have like an isocyanurate insulation with a taper in it, so that this flat roof, which has really become a bowled roof, that is a roof like a bowl, can once again become a low pitch roof, so the water can run to the sides and be collected in the gutters. Some flat roofs, especially ones designed by architects, will drain to only 2 or 3 places. Those are usually called scupper ports. And so the water gets really concentrated. Now that can be good and that can be bad. If the scupper goes into a downspout where we can easily move the water away from the house, that's great. But if the scupper goes to a flat part of the yard, we really have a problem there trying to manage all of that roof water that is coming off in those one or two places. So I have to agree with Dennis that flat roofs can be an issue. They're an issue simply because of the nature of wood construction, but we can indeed manage that. And many of these old flat roof houses have no attics. So have an interstitial space, maybe 2x8s or 2x10s, so they don't have much insulation. So adding these tapered foam insulation above it really can improve those houses and at least make the upper insulation equal to a new home.
Oh, Makes good sense. Let's take another call. Joe in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hey, fellas. Thanks for another great show. Hey, I have a 1926 bungalow, and I had some water in the basement, did some outside landscaping, but I decided to put a sump pump in with a drain tile about 10 years ago. Everything's great. I'm just wondering, essentially, since I'm channeling the water under the ground, am I going to cause any issue to the foundation in 20, 30, 40, 50 years?
Joe, what do you mean by you're channeling the water under the ground?
Well, essentially what they did is they took a big drill and, you know, they drilled through the cinder block all the way through, and then they cemented the interior. They did that on the first cinder block, and then they went up about 4 feet, and they did it again. So now they're encouraging water to come in through the cinder block, if you will, and then the sub pump is spitting it out. So
okay,
there's got to be all sorts of like tributaries down there. And is that going to cause any issue with the foundation in 50 years?
Probably not. In fact, it's probably going to improve the life of the foundation. And here's why, Joe. It is cinder blocks or concrete masonry units or concrete blocks, whatever we call them, generally have hollows. At least all of the 8 and 10 and 12 inches that I know do. So once water gets in it, it drains right down to the bottom of the block. So wise people who install the retrofitted drain tile will drill into every single hollow. And I've seen some of them actually put a clear plastic tube underneath the concrete floor so that it drains really well into the drain tile. So you end up really with sort of a you've got a horizontal water collection system in your drain tile, then you've got a vertical one in your block wall, and that's really pretty smart. And the reason it may actually help your foundation is block foundations are very weak laterally. You can stack everything in the world on top of them, but you can't push on the sides. And if you have really wet soil around your house and that soil freezes and then expands 5 to 7%, that is where we see most of our damage to block foundations. So if this system they have put in is actually drying out the soil around the house, that's great. You're less likely to have frost damage. Now, over the years, every house, every foundation gets a certain amount of subsidence around it. And we've got to be careful to rake the mulch off the flower bed. And then sometimes we find that right next to the house, it's 4 inches lower than the yard. So we need to rake that mulch off, add some soil, put the mulch back. So watch for a little bit of settling, but basically it sounds like what you've done there is not only helped your basement water problem, but you're doing a little bit of drainage in the yard, and that may prolong the life of your concrete masonry unit wall.
So there you go. You did a good thing there. Thanks very much for calling. Pete emailed, wondering whether if you have an opinion on the steel mesh or grid barriers installed on rain gutters designed to keep, you know, leaves and other debris off the gutters. They do the job, but during heavy rainfalls, he sees lots of water coming down the roof and skidding off the barriers and being deposited at the base of his foundation. Do they solve one problem and cause another?
That is correct. The ones that particularly seem to be a problem in heavy rains are the gutter helmet ones, which are basically a solid piece of metal with a curve at the edge. And they're supposed to cover the top of the gutter, but then the water is supposed to follow the edge, basically with surface tension, I guess, and go into the gutters. And we see water shooting off the top of those all the time. So it's really it really is a bit of a problem. It often depends upon the size of the gutter, because the bigger the gutter is, the better they're going to work. And then it depends upon the type of trees. If you've got a bunch of white oaks around the house with these big leaves, they tend to alight on top of the mesh and they blow off the roof. But if you've got a bunch of spruce trees with these little tiny needles, what happens is that the mesh just gets completely full. So you really have to take a look at your exact situation with your house. Is this one story, two stories? Is it up three stories? Every different house is going to be slightly different. And you're going to have to make a decision whether you want to try to use some sort of gutter guard system or gutter mesh or whatever, based upon exactly how your house works.
That makes good sense. Well, let's take another call. Lori and Shano, your turn. Hi, Lori.
Hello. My question is, now your guest had mentioned something about a deck earlier, that prefer the composite decks, but some of those are made of plastic. Does that get dry and brittle in extreme heat? Because I want to add onto my wood deck with this, with the composite, but and does it fade in the sun? And he had also mentioned something about a deep maroon color, but I didn't get the company that he said that was through.
Okay, John?
Yes, well, the color fastness of the deck material, frankly, I don't know. I think it often depends upon the colors, and the colors vary from sort of light wood colors into, I've seen some dark grays and dark maroons. I'd be a little bit concerned with some of the dark colors that they might get some fading over time. It just seems that that is probably going to happen, but I really have no experience in evaluating that, that, Lori. So the question is, you know, we have our wood decks, we're painting them, and the more we paint them, the faster they peel because there's always cracks in them. So, you know, which is the most onerous, to have some fading in the PVC type or plastic materials, or to be continuously painting our decks? I don't know. And I think, was it the American Wood Council, Larry, she wanted us to repeat the name of that publication? Yeah, so it's the American Wood Council Deck Code Conformance Guide. If you just go to American Wood Council, type in deck, it'll pop right up for you. And if you can't find it, you can email me at frei@chorus.net, chorus like a group of singers, C-H-O-R-U-S, and I'd be happy to send you any publication that I mentioned during this program, because we've got a pretty good library here, and we're always happy to send those out to you.
All right, Lori, does that help?
Yes, it does. Thanks.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. John Freiberger, our guest today, Wisconsin registered home inspector, his company Freiberger and Associates. I'm Larry Mueller. Tim Peterson, our on-air producer today, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look at home improvement. We've talked a bit about diverting water with landscaping. We've talked about decks. What about you? Question? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You want to see that list of that John had put together on how to garden to improve your house, go to ideas@wpr.org and look under program notes, and you will find that information right there. Well, let's take another call here. We've got Connie and Delavan waiting, so let's go to Connie. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. My husband and I bought a house last fall, and it had been vacant for a year. It's got a crawl space, about a 4 foot high concrete crawl space, and we had to do some mold remediation down there. We put in rain gutters. We put some slope next to the foundation to draw the water away. We have a sump pump, but our question now is, there are air vents going into the crawl space, and in the summertime we want to have a dehumidifier down there. Should we leave the air vents open, that's letting the humidity in there, or should we close those off?
Connie, are those vents that are going from a basement into the crawl space or from the exterior into the crawl space?
From the exterior.
Okay, and those vents were required, well, by building code, once the Uniform Dwelling Code was adopted, but were commonly used back in the 1860s and 1870s, basically to keep the air changed a little bit in the crawl space. And, well, we finally come to a consensus on crawl spaces. Vents don't work. They don't work going to the exterior, especially because in the summer we're drawing moist air into the crawl space. The crawl space, you know, so let's say it's 90 degrees outside, Connie, and you're in a fairly damp area in Delavan, and that humidity is at 70%, and it gets drawn into the crawl space where then it drops to 55 or 60 degrees. Well, suddenly you've got condensation and you're doing mold remediation all over again. So what we are telling people with crawl spaces now is we want to really redesign them. A lot of crawl spaces have insulation on the ceiling of the crawl space trying to keep the floor warm. And we're taking out all of that insulation. We're insulating the ring joist, and we're insulating the outside walls. We're sealing the vents. We're sealing the floor. And then we're getting a drain and a dehumidifier in there. We even suggest that we actually run a heat duct and a return into the crawl space. So we're really adding the crawl space into what we call the conditioned space. So in other words, it's treated as if you were living in there. That reduces the radon to basically zero, makes the humidity completely controllable, makes the floors warmer, and actually has a positive effect on lowering your energy bill. It's a whole bunch of work, Connie, but it is really worth doing because moisture issues and mold issues in crawl space have been bedeviling us since the 1870s.
Connie, does that help?
That is kind of the way we were thinking, but we wanted a professional input on it. So thank you. That's very helpful.
All right. Thanks, Connie.
Yeah, Connie, Larry, if Connie would email me, I can send her a very good article by Joel Stilbrick from Cambridge Building Science, where in about 10 pages in the ASHRAE Journal, he summarizes basically where we are as far as building science and crawl space nowadays.
And that's Frei, F-R-E-I, at chorus.net.
That is correct, Larry.
All right. Thanks again, Connie. Appreciate it. Let's go to Travis in Eau Claire next. Hi, Travis. Your turn. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Just some input on the person that called in regards to the extruded wood products.
Yeah.
I've worked for a company for 14 years, and I saw firsthand how it's made to all the way it comes out to the end. And the process, it all depends on the colorant that's added. And you're right, the darker colors do sometimes fade, but the lighter colors will fade to white. The darker colors will become like a whitish red or a whitish gray. And that is going to happen no matter what you do. So there's no way to stop it. But the best thing is, well, there is a way to stop it. Don't build the deck where the sun ever hits it, because the sunlight's what damages it, and the sunlight is the one that causes the colors to fade. There's no way to stop it. And each manufacturer that I saw has a data sheet that warranties the color fastness, typically, because once that runs out, there's nothing you can do about getting it replaced.
All right. Travis, thank you so much.
Good reminder from Travis there to check our material data sheets and check our warranties whenever we buy anything. And these things are all available. If they don't have it at your local lumber yard or the big box, it is going to be available online.
And again, Travis, thank you. Larry in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Larry.
Hi. You have a great guest on today. I have a question about rain coming down my driveway. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Yeah, I have a farm property, and it's running. I'm not too concerned about it coming to the house, but all this water, it's finally saturated my yard, and it's overwhelming my septic system. I graded the driveway, which is like 75 yards, so it slopes away, but the rain's coming down so hard that it gets to the backyard and floods out the area, and it's encroaching my house. Is there some way of trenching the water away so it doesn't rush down the driveway?
Larry, there probably is. I've been doing some work up in the Oshkosh and Nenagh Menasha area, And one of the problems, I don't know whether this is your problem or not, but we've got bedrock that's only down a few feet. And we have houses that have been there for 20 years and are suddenly having horrendous flooding problems. And part of it is, as we mentioned early in the program, is we've had rainfall in Wisconsin almost double the last 3 years. And the long term, I think the last one I saw was 17 or 19% increase over the 50-year average. So we're running into a lot of problems. But, you know, you can check the grade on your driveway, get as much of it to go to the common ditches or whatever. But unfortunately, if your yard and soil are just getting saturated, you may have to take a look at putting in a dewatering system. And those, unfortunately, are really expensive. Basically, what we're doing is we started talking about rain gardens. Well, this is basically like a rain barrel. We're digging a large hole in a yard, and we're letting the water that's below the surface run into it, and then we're pumping it someplace. And the problem is, at Larry's place, where are we going to pump it? If Larry's on fairly flat farmland, getting it to a public ditch or someplace will run away, maybe possible, or then again, it may not. On my own farm, I put in a fairly large pond, which is pumpable into existing drainage ditches. But that is one way that I'm controlling the really overwhelming soil moisture that we're getting on some of our flatter farm neighborhoods. And we have the same problem in some of the flatter city neighborhoods. I've actually seen people put dewatering into their yards in properties that are, say, 200 or 300 meters from the lake, to try to reduce the hydrostatic pressure on their basement walls. So, Larry, it's a really difficult situation. I don't know if you're in a rural township, if they've got an engineer that they might have sort of on retainer. As most jurisdictions have some sort of engineer, but maybe give the town hall a call and say, look, I've got a problem. I don't want to make it worse for a neighbor. Do we have a professional that could come out and consult with me a little bit? And see if maybe the town government can be of help.
That's good advice. Larry, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Tony and Appleton a chance to join in. Tony, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you very much. I also am one of the gutter people who have issues because I have many maple trees on my property. One product I have seen advertised nationally is a replacement for your gutters, and it looks like a 4 or 5 louver type extension that you put in place of the gutter, and it's the philosophy is that it's supposed to catch the water as it runs off your rooftop and spatter it out 3, 4, 5 feet into the yard instead of collecting it like we typically do with gutters. In theory, that sounds good to me because there's nothing to collect leaves, there's nothing to plug up. But my question for you is, I don't know if this thing would work, and you may not have even heard of it.
I'm curious to know if you
just have some background on it.
Yeah.
No, I've seen them, and I've told people they need to take them off their house and put gutters on. They simply don't work. To get the velocity that you would need for this to scatter stuff 5 feet is simply the physics don't work on it. If you've got a slab on grade house and you just don't want to have that little trench that you can get around a house if you have no gutters and water drips off the roof, they're fine for something like that. But if you've got a basement, you do not want these things on your house.
Very much.
All right. Thanks, Tony. Thanks for calling. Team in
Hortonville. Every now and then I give a firm opinion based upon experience, and that's one of them, Larry.
Okay. Oh, man. Tim in Hortonville emailed to ask what's the best or proper way to finish concrete basement walls. Should he put on a sealer? He knows insulation stops interior condensation, but should he also use a plastic moisture barrier? If so, between concrete and insulation, or to the inside of the insulation?
You're actually not allowed to use a plastic barrier in the basement of a house. The Uniform Dwelling Code was changed some years ago because they found that the plastic was trapping water and causing more problems. So it's pretty difficult. If you are going to be finishing a basement, you need to really talk to somebody who can design it for you, which is usually going to be an architect or an engineer. There are ways that we can finish basements where we get moisture through the wall, but we have to really be able to control that moisture. Inside sealers do not work. They are helpful because where it blisters off the fastest is where it tells you where you've got the most moisture, but you can't count on them to work. We often suggest that people will paint their grungy-looking basement walls with a product that is called a sealer, like ThoroSeal or Kiln, but that those are sealers that work on the exterior as water barriers, but they work on the inside as a silicate-based paint that mold won't grow on. So I think you're going to want to get a little bit of professional advice on this design so that the humidity and the occasional leak through this wall does not cause a lot of mold growth in your basement.
John Freiberger of Freiberger Associates of Fitchburg and Madison, our guest today. He's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today to take your home improvement questions. Hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Take a quick look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking home improvement with our regular guest, John Freiberger, Wisconsin registered home inspector, specializes in evaluating older homes, and his firm, Freiberger & Associates, consults in restoring and the adaptive reuse of older homes. So it's great to have him with us today. Do you need help with a home improvement project? Join the conversation. Our number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. John, we just heard on the news there were some references to social distancing and so forth. How has social distancing affected your industry?
Well, I'm working as little as possible, Larry. And there's a reason that I'm not seeing your smiling face across the desk from me today. And I'm doing that a lot. I'm doing whatever I can by email from the office. We are listed as essential. We have people that have structural problems and things, and so we're going out and looking at them. But we're trying to very much limit what we do to comply with the suggestions to socially distance as much as possible.
Well, we have a lot of time at home these days. And, you know, this spring here, we've talked about a few things relating to water and so forth, but what are some other things we should be checking around the house?
Well, when I put the checklist together for your website, Larry, I was sort of thinking about what are the problems that I've been seeing the last couple of years since things have gotten wetter. And we already talked about trying to have the 6 to 8 inches of clearance with your siding. The area where we run into a lot of problems, and we're seeing it more and more, is houses that have masonry on them. Now, modern masonry, veneer, that is full-width bricks or stone, is supposed to be applied to your house with a 1-inch airspace behind. That is in the Uniform Dwelling Code, so that is a state standard. 90% of the brick and stone is not put on that way. It is not put on with weeps. If you have an older house from the 50s, 60s, or 70s, or going way back, the 1880s, with brick on it, weeps were not used back then. There were air spaces, but they were often quite small. And what we are seeing with the increased precipitation in Wisconsin is we're seeing more deterioration of our walls. So while we're out walking around the house, if we've got a brick or stone house, we want to take a look at the bottom of the walls. We're probably going to find we don't have weeps. Let's say we have a 3-year-old house and we have weeps and they're 4 inches underground. Well, we know that that's an issue, don't we? Because then the weeps are taking in water instead of weeping it out. If we have a a house with no weeps, and we start seeing a lot of efflorescence, a white powdery mineral salts and things growing on coming through the brick or the stone, or if we see cracking in the mortar, movement in the mortar, then we probably have some evidence that we're developing a moisture problem in that cladding and that we're probably going to have to get a professional to come in and look at it. Most houses in the old days had a layer of felt paper, and felt paper is great stuff. It's been around for 100 and some years, and we still occasionally specify it for some work, but it doesn't last forever. And if it becomes saturated enough, it does let some water through. And what we've been finding on houses is that once the masonry becomes saturated for too long, the felt paper or the weather-resistant barrier, the Tyvek or whatever behind it starts letting water through, and then we start seeing deterioration in the wood in the houses. So if you have brick on your house and you suspect there may be a problem, you can do a further inspection, but it can be done from the interior. If you can get to the basement wall or a crawl space wall opposite the brick and pull the insulation out of the sill boxes, that area where the concrete or stone or brick or block foundation meets the framing, you can look in there to see if you are getting mold or decay. So that would be a second follow-up you can do. Obviously, if you get in there and you start seeing decayed wood, then you're going to need to call a professional home inspector or a forensic mason or somebody to come and help you. We have recent houses where we found that the back wall, we just did one where the back wall of the house dropped almost 2 inches due to decay of the ring joists. So basically, we're going to have contractors going into the crawl space, working in a 3-foot crawl space, shoring it up, lifting up the house, cutting out the patio that was poured dead tight to the siding and sent all the water in. And this is going to be a very expensive proposition on a fairly small house. So getting out there and using this checklist to look for the water problems is real important, because as the weather gets wetter, the walls get wetter. As the walls get wetter, we're going to get more mold and decay in Wisconsin.
Boy. And if people go to WPR.org and go to our comments section, they're going to find that list of things that John has put together. So great advice again, John. Let's take an email here from Cecilia. She wonders, she's going to apply Australian timber oil to an old deck that's been prepared. Should she be adding sand or something to it to assure it won't be slippery in the rain?
I don't think so. I just noticed I had a can of Australian timber oil when I was cleaning out the paint room this last week. Social distancing means I spend a lot of time cleaning, Larry. And I did not run into any problems with slipperiness with either Australian timber oil, with exterior grade tung oil. So I have not seen a problem with any of those. Now, if this was an extremely closed pour, you know, maybe a teak or something, maybe that would get slippery. But most of our decks are either pine or they're Doug fir or they're something where there is some differential in the grain, and so they don't get slippery. But you can always do a test spot first, right, and let it cure for a week. Yep. And then just slide your foot across it and see whether it feels slippery or not. But putting grains of sand or some sort of grit into wood usually creates more problems than it's worth. Part of it because it has a tendency to cut into the wood itself, past the oil, and so we can end up with more rapid deterioration. So it's a product that I have used in the past. I have been using a specialized polymerized tung oil instead of the Australian timber oil, but I don't know of any problems with the Australian timber oil.
Let's take another call. Tom in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I am a landlord. I have two buildings, a two-family and a single-family, one 35 feet from the East River in Green Bay, and the other one is 50 feet from the river. Beautiful view, beautiful. One's a two-family.
beautiful views down the river, just spectacular. Unfortunately, I'm not able to rent them anymore because of flooding that gets on the street going to these two buildings from high water and rain that actually has made these two buildings into an island. Now, I can't in good faith rent them out because people obviously can't get to the buildings if you have 2 feet of water in the street periodically. The city said they don't have any money. City of Green Bay has no money to raise the street, and they have no money to buy the buildings, which I would really hate to sell, but what do? You know, the buildings are kind of priceless because you can never build that close to the water again and have those kind of views.
Yeah.
What do you suggest?
Oh, dear. I'm afraid we're getting a little bit out of my league here. It sounds like you've got a property that is probably ripe for redevelopment. You know, the question is, in this economic climate and things, and depending upon the neighborhood, there are times when houses reach the end of their life, and we simply need to take them down and put up something of more value. But sometimes the neighborhood doesn't really allow that. Now, I have worked on houses in floodplains, and we have raised houses, and it isn't that terribly expensive. So it might be possible, depending upon the age and condition of this property, to have a house mover come in and basically raise the house 4 feet or so. The problem is the city street, though, isn't it? If the city street is simply a problem that can't be managed, keeping the yard and the house high and dry isn't going to help. So I really don't know where to go on this one. I think you probably need to talk to your alder. Of course, you need to get your property assessment brought down to as close to zero as you could get it. But usually I find in cities, if you talk to the town chairman or you talk to your alder person, that seems to be the way to start to see what sort of resources the government can bring to helping you.
All right. Thanks so much for that call. We have Rich in Two Rivers next with a question.
Yeah.
Hi, Rich.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah,
sure.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I got a question. I got a small 2-acre lot with a mound system that's probably 20 feet from the house. And I was putting in the garden yesterday and putting peat moss in the wet spot on the one corner. And I buried my pickup truck. I had to have somebody pull me out. And that wet spot there, I was thinking, I was thinking of maybe putting a koi pond right there. Now, it doesn't have to be real big and doesn't have to be real deep. But and then maybe having an inlet and outlet that goes out to the ditch, which is another 50 feet and with French tile. And if I do that, what kind of liner do I need, or what type of inlet or outlet do I need?
Oh my! Well, we're getting into a question here where we need to really talk to a pond specialist, I think. And the question is whether you've got a local landscaper who has pond experience. I've designed a couple of them, but they've been it was very labor intense for me to educate myself. There certainly are all kinds of liners. There are clay liners. There are EPDM liners. There are vinyl liners. So there's lots of things out there. I think I would start by calling local landscapers, see if you have someone who has some expertise. You may want to try to analyze why that area is so wet. Is this a real flat lot in a flat area?
Well, it's got a flat lot above it, and it goes off a steep hill, and then it drains all the way down to that mound system, and then the water just sits right in that corner all year long. Not water, it's just grass, but it's moist all the time.
Right. Yeah, so you've got saturated soil in that point. You know, the water table is pretty close to the top. It would be interesting to, I think, what I did out here, I mentioned earlier, Rick, that I ended up building a pond on my farm. And I built it because I had an area that was perennially wet. And so I dug a hole in the ground, and it filled up with water. And then I pumped it for 2 weeks, and it never dried out. So basically, I found I have a spring. So before you put money into putting in a pond and an overflow and all of this piping, why don't you go out there and dig a 2-foot deep hole and see what happens? If that fills up with water and stays full of water, well, then maybe your pond idea is not a bad one, but maybe you're going to have an open bottom pond because you're not keeping the water in. You want the water to come in from underground. And then maybe a drain would make a certain amount of sense. So find out a little bit about your soil conditions first. And by digging a hole, you're going to see that. You can find whether you've got clay, whether you've got silt, whether you've got sand or whatever. And with that information, you can probably then talk to a landscaper or a landscape architect or a soils engineer or somebody who can give you an idea of whether this is worth putting money into or not.
Oh,
if
there
it's
you go.
A wet spot and that hole doesn't fill up with water, well, maybe we dig it out a little bit further and we put in a nice wet prairie rain garden, as we started talking about early in the hour. It'll be a place where water can exist, can soak in, and, of course, the prairie plants themselves are going to take a lot of that water, and they're going to expire it right into the air. So
there you
research
go.
Research first, I think, and then see what makes sense.
Thank you, Rich. Appreciate the call. Ben in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just had some question about some electrical work. We have an older home. Almost all of the outlets are two-prong. And I talked to an electrician and said this project is kind of do-it-yourself, but I'm just having one issue. So want to replace them all to three-prong. And he said for safety reasons, the first one in the circuit needs to be a fused outlet. And then the rest can be three-prong, but I'm having trouble. I just don't know of a good system of finding out which outlets are all contained on each circuit, just that way I know when I turn off the breaker which ones are dead and which ones are live, if that question makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ben, what type of wiring do you have in the house? Is it metallic cable?
Most of what I've seen in the light fixtures is knob and tube. I think there's a handful of more modern wire, okay. But mostly it's knob and tube wiring.
Okay. Well, the knob and tube cannot be grounded because it's a two-wire system. The other problem that you're going to run into in some years is you're not going to be able to get insurance on your house. Right now, if you were selling the house or buying the house, you would not be able to buy it because the insurance company would not insure it. The problem with knob and tube is it's a heat-dissipating system, so it wasn't great copper, so if you run a bunch of current through it, it gets warm to the touch. Now, you can make it a bit safer by putting GFCI outlets on it. That doesn't ground it, but at least it shuts it off. But I think what you probably need to think about is having the entire house evaluated by an electrician, and sometime in the next few years, you're going to have to take that knob and tube out and replace it. One of the big problems that we have with knob and tube is people have insulated their houses. So they put insulation in the attic over the knob and tube, and they put insulation in the walls around the knob and tube wiring. And that wiring is trying to dissipate heat, and it can no longer dissipate heat. So it ends up burning the insulation off and then arcing. And the reason the insurance companies don't want to insure houses with knob and tube anymore is because they get too many fire claims. So I think you better consult with a good restoration electrician and come up with perhaps a multi-year plan to get rid of that knob and tube and to replace it with a modern grounded system.
All right. Kind of expensive news there maybe, Ben, but thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Linda.
Larry, one thing to note on these people with these older houses is that if they would be fortunate enough to be in a federally recognized historic district, or if they had a house that was historic on its own right and could be listed on the State Historical Society's list of historic buildings, then to replace knob and tube, there would be a 25% state income tax credit for that work. And anyone can go to wisconsinhistory.org, type in your house, your address, if you have an old house, and see if it pops up and if it has been inventoried. Sometimes you get a surprise, and there your house is already on the register or it is eligible for the register. In that case, you can check to see if tax credits would be available to replace your old knob and tube wiring, your old plumbing, your old furnace or boiler, your old roof, or restore your old windows. So anyone who owns an old house should go to wisconsinhistory.org, press the green link on the right side of the page, and then review the information that the state has provided for old homeowners.
Let's take a call from Linda. Linda, do you have a quick question for Madison?
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. We are considering either painting our basement floor or putting some sort of laminate on the floor that has a fake wood kind of look. There are a lot of different products. The basement has been dry for the last 19 years, thanks to you, John, the cat. Your consulting work with us, and we're just wondering if there is any advice, pros and cons, for any particular product to either use or stay away from.
Well, you certainly want to stay away from anything that can grow mold that is porous, and ceramic, of course, is the best thing for basements, but it tends to be a little on the expensive side. You have some very good flooring companies in Madison, not big box stores, but you've got companies in Madison that have been around for a long time selling flooring. The LVT luxury vinyl tile, the snap together type that you do not have to glue down. There is a line made for basement floors now because basement floors tend to be a little bit uneven. And it was designed for the little ridges and bumps and things in basement floors to not show through. So I would consult with a quality flooring specialist there in Madison, and I'd probably talk to two or three of them, and see what they have for a non-glued down, snap together, or maybe edge adhered LVT or similar material that is actually specifically designed for basements, because it is out there. And I saw some stuff on just about 2 weeks ago that some women put into their basement, and it looked absolutely great. So
there you go.
All you have to do is find it.
Linda, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And John, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Your website is educatedhomeowner.net, and email Frei at chorus.net. Really appreciate it. And John, we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Larry. Good being with you.
Yeah, good being with you as well. John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates. By way of disclosure, we should mention that Freiberger Consulting is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. So we appreciate that as well. And certainly appreciate you listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.